The Meaning of Marxism by Paul D'Amato. Section. Can Black and White Unite? After losing the Civil War, the old Southern planter class aimed at, quote, getting things back as near to slavery as possible. But they were temporarily stymied during the period of radical Reconstruction. Blacks were granted the right to vote. In some cities, laws restricting the rights of black people were thrown out. Biracial public education was established, where there had never been before any public education. 14 blacks were elected to Congress from the South. These changes also benefited poor whites, who had no public education and few rights under slavery. The importance of this period is that it showed how quickly racist ideas could break down in periods of rapid change. But by the 1870s, the Northern capitalists joined the Southern planter class in being eager to put an end to radical Reconstruction. They feared the possibility that a population of poor whites and blacks, quote, if combined for any political purpose, would sweep away all opposition the intelligent class might make, as the New York Tribune opined in 1871. The Southern ruling class successfully defeated Reconstruction by using racism, Klan terror, and fraud. The biggest threat to their rule came with the populist movement in the 1890s. A national movement of farmers and sharecroppers who were losing their farms to bankers and speculators, the populace vowed to, quote, raise less corn and more hell. Populism's most radical wing was in the South. The Georgia populist Tom Watkins said of the government, there is no remedy for it but destruction. The movement began to break down the divisions between blacks and whites. The Southern Alliance, a multi-state league of populist farmers, claimed 3 million members, 1.3 million of them black, in 1890. Watson appealed to black and white tenant farmers, saying, quote, you are made to hate each other because upon that hatred is rested the keystone of the arch of financial despotism that enslaves you both. End quote. When a leading black populist was threatened with lynching, 2,000 white farmers responded to Tom Watson's appeal for help to defend him. Fearing that populism was a threat to their class rule, the planters resurrected a campaign of violence and intimidation. The cry of black domination was raised to convince poor whites that racial supremacy was in their interests. But the movement kept growing. It collapsed in 1896 when the Populist People's Party decided to back Democratic presidential candidate William Jennings Bryan, based on the argument that he was a lesser evil to the Republican McKinley. Bryan adopted the rhetoric of populism, but he was no populist. His job was to kill the People's Party in a smothering Democratic Party embrace. With the collapse of the movement in the South, the Southern ruling class used a variety of devices, like poll taxes, literacy tests, and property qualifications to disenfranchise blacks. Poor whites did not benefit from the defeat of populism. On the contrary, in the process of disenfranchising blacks, the Southern planters also disenfranchised poor whites. In Louisiana, the black vote declined by 90%. The white vote also declined by 60%. And this pattern was repeated throughout the South. One Southern newspaper aptly described the move to impose white supremacy as, quote, "the struggle of the white people of North Carolina to rid themselves of the danger of the rule of Negroes and the lower class whites." End quote. The populist movement gives us a glimpse of what enormous changes are possible if the oppressed and exploited unite against their common enemy. But it also explains why the ruling class depends upon racism to keep workers divided. The use of black strikebreakers in the past, for example, was a classic tactic that the employers used to divide workers and weaken their organizing efforts. During and immediately after the First World War, for instance, employers saw in black workers migrating north, quote, "the effective means of staving off or preventing the movement towards organization, which is now spreading among the foreign worker," end quote, explained the manager of a Pittsburgh factory. The steel corporations quite consciously and deliberately used black strikebreakers to defeat the 1919 steel strike. There have been high points of class struggle where black and white workers united to fight their common exploiters. Appeals to racism by lumber mill operators failed to break the unity of 1,300 black and white workers who struck a Louisiana lumber company in 1913. In the end, only violent repression worked. Prior to the strike, Industrial Workers of the World leader Big Bill Haywood had succeeded in convincing the black and white workers of the Southern Lumber Workers Union to affiliate with the IWW. In defiance of Jim Crow laws, black and white workers also agreed to meet in the same hall. "Let the Negroes come together with us," announced the assembled white union members. Quote, "And if any arrests are made, all of us will go to jail, white and colored together." End quote. In the upsurge of industrial unionism in the 1930s, black and white unity was commonly forged in struggle. But it didn't come about automatically. It had to be encouraged and fought for. Ferdinand C. Smith, a black member of the Communist Party and a founding member of the Congress of Industrial Organizations National Maritime Union, was acutely aware of how the employers attempted to use racial animosity to break down labor solidarity. Quote, "If the companies show preference for men of one race now, it is only for the time being. Once they get us divided, they will attack one race just as viciously as another. They know that race equality in a trade union is necessary to successful trade unionism. And successful trade unionism is the one thing they fear most." End quote. There have also been periods of intense racism where blacks felt so cornered that separation seemed the only option. But while racism sometimes impels blacks to organize separately against their oppression, African Americans cannot end racism through their efforts alone. This is not only because blacks constitute a minority of society, it is also because what is referred to as, quote, "the black community" is divided by competing class interests. An appeal based on nationalist terms cannot address this division. Quote, "As a political current, black nationalism is extremely heterogeneous, including advocates of black capitalism, cultural nationalism, reformist politicians, and revolutionaries who oppose the system," notes Ahmed Shaki. Beginning of long quote. What all varieties of black separatism share is inconsistency and vacillation, This is necessarily built into all varieties of black separatism, because neither the analysis nor strategy locate the one agent capable of transforming capitalist society, the working class. So while a separatist strategy can often tap the alienation felt by blacks, it cannot provide a solution to the problems that face the mass of black workers. At times, black nationalist ideas can be radical in their critique of capitalism, as the Black Panthers were. But they can also be much more conservative and pro-capitalist, stressing the need for racial unity as the basis for black capitalism. End quote. The civil rights and black power movements posed a serious challenge to racism in the United States. The struggle was carried in the main by mostly poor and working class African Americans, though it had the support and participation of many whites too. These struggles did not end racial oppression, however. The civil rights movement lifted up the black middle class and small black bourgeoisie far more than it did the majority of poor and working class blacks. Today, African Americans still face double the unemployment rate of whites. Though they constitute 12% of the population, blacks are half of those in prison. And decades after Brown v. Board of Education, cities and schools are still heavily segregated in the North and South. The end of racial oppression can only come when the system that fosters and depends on it, capitalism, is ended. That requires a body blow delivered by a united working class. Only a conscious, organized battle against racism can foster that kind of unity. Lance Selfa, in an essay on the origins of racism, sums up the matter well. Quote, "First, racism is not part of some unchanging human nature. It was literally invented, and so it can be torn down. Second, despite the overwhelming ideological hold of white supremacy, people always resisted it, from the slaves themselves to white anti-racists. Understanding racism in this way informs the strategy that we use to combat racism. Anti-racist education is essential, but it is not enough. Because it treats racism only as a question of, quote, bad ideas, it does not address the underlying material conditions that give rise to the acceptance of racism among large sections of workers. Thoroughly undermining the hold of racism on large sections of workers requires three conditions. First, a broader class fight that unites workers across racial lines. Second, attacking the conditions, bad jobs, housing, education, etc., that give rise to the appeal of racism among large sections of workers. And third, the conscious intervention of anti-racists to oppose racism in all its manifestations, and to win support for interracial class solidarity." End quote, and end of section.